order at 8:21 a.m. The clerk will note the roll. We're one person short of a quorum right now, but we're going to get started with admin's overview of the governor's recommendations on the budget. Good morning. If you would identify yourself for the tape and give your position title, and then proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sheila Rieger. I am the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Administration. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. As you might recall, we were here a few weeks ago going over our general budget, and we're back today to give more specific information about the change items proposed. In considering areas for the possible budget reductions, we looked at a variety of things. We wanted to be respectful to the statutory obligations we have. We wanted to continue to provide fundamentals, minimize reductions that would cost pass costs onto other agencies in particular. We wanted to assure the best value and capitalize on opportunities for improving cost effectiveness. Our proposed base level reduction is $2.245 million. That is a 15.7% cut to our general fund. As I mentioned, today we're here to present more detailed information. And sitting with me here is the manager of the Land Management Information Center, commonly known as LMIC. We will start with LMIC and then move to the Local Planning Assistance Center, and then follow up with the Office of Technology and the Faith-Based Initiative.
Okay. We're going to officially call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum right now, and go ahead and proceed. Is this the Faith-Based Initiative? Is that something that came out in the supplemental?
It did.
Okay. Thank you.
The first of the divisions we're going to go over is as I said, LMIC. LMIC's been around, and local planning, since the early 70s, and they've gone through a variety of changes, expansions, reductions, movement to different agencies, and finally are back with the Department of Administration. The programs that you'll hear about today are very good programs. They're not being proposed for elimination due to any performance issues or any lack of value to the organization or indeed to the state of Minnesota. I wanted to mention, too, before I turn it over to David Arbein, that both he and our local planning assistance director are here today, and I wanted to just commend them, if I could. They're in a really tough position of having to be here today to talk about cutting, in one case, her entire program, and in David's case, a pretty significant cut to LMIC. Both of them have worked admirably and are here today to give you objective information about what this reduction would mean to their organization. So we'll start with LMIC.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Arbeit. I've been director of the Land Management Information Center since 1994. I'm here to talk to you today about the governor's recommendation, which will reduce our general fund appropriation by $837,000, leaving us with $258,000 in appropriation, plus other revenues that we generate through fees, contracts for services, and when we're a little bit lucky, grants as well. I'm here to talk to you a little bit about what we do now, and then I'll talk about the reductions and how we're going to try to make adjustments to that bottom line number. LMIC's mission is to support the effective and efficient use of geographic data and geographic information technology. It's commonly known as GIS, or Geographic Information Systems. The technology is widely used around the state. We support the activities of other organizations, state agencies, and other organizations around the state through coordination, data clearinghouse services, decision support tools that make that technology easier to use, and then through our consulting operation, which is supported through fees. Over the period that we've been in operation, starting in 1977, when the legislature created LMIC as the first state organization anywhere in the nation to bring GIS technology to a state government, the technology itself has evolved from a technology that was still under development. In fact, Minnesota and LMIC was involved in the development of the technology to a widely commercialized technology that's available and being deployed all over the state. And along with that change, our role has changed from that of being a sole provider of that service to focus on coordination activities that help promote and support collaborative solutions to common needs. We do that by representing Minnesota as Minnesota's liaison to federal agencies and to national organizations that represent state interests, promoting coordination across state lines and around the nation. We do that by supporting and promoting partnerships within Minnesota, such as the Metro GIS Project, which has been a successful effort to coordinate, provide shared resources among the seven counties in the Metro. We've advocated, developed, promoted, and supported state data and technology standards. In fact, our organization led the effort to develop the first state data content standards ever adopted by the state, and the first state data documentation standards ever adopted by the state, and they're both widely in use. We support something called the Minnesota Governor's Council on Geographic Information, which was first established by Governor Carlson in 1991 as an advisory group, bringing together organizations that use that information and depend on that technology around the state to provide advice about direction, policy, and coordination. And we rely heavily on their advice. And we work with the council and other entities over the last several years to develop a strategic plan for statewide GIS, which is adopted by that council in June. That plan calls for more coordination than we currently have, actually. We also recognize, as within the industry it's sometimes said, that 80% or maybe even more of the cost of using GIS or deploying it is actually in the data itself, developing the data, acquiring the data, maintaining the data. And as other organizations have begun to find that GIS is a valuable tool for their operations to make them do things better, faster, and actually cheaper, we've sort of adopted the philosophy of develop once, use many with data, and have assumed the role of a data clearinghouse for both the state's data assets and data developed by other organizations around the state. This is something that the Council on Geographic Information asked us to do, and we've since implemented that. Under that umbrella, we are stewards for statewide data assets. There are actually probably at least $20 million in state investments in data that are housed at LMIC. We are the stewards for that data, and we make that available to other organizations to use. We also provide services focusing on web services as we've developed technologies to make it easier for organizations to publish data that they have that they're willing to share with other organizations so that they can come to LMIC, the LMIC web portal, the Data Clearinghouse portal, and find data that 80% of the cost of their GIS implementation that they need for their organizations. We're now supporting about 6,000 downloads a month. We estimate that in FY05 that will result in cost avoidance of more than $7 million to organizations that are benefiting from that service, and that the return on investment is something in the order of 20-1. We also research and catalog data that are being developed by other organizations and have value to for GIS users within the state, and then document it so that they know where that data is, and broker a connection to the provider through the clearinghouse. And we also support and have done a lot of training around the state. This is sometimes supported by grants where we can get them to train organizations and people in other organizations to document their data so that they are in a standardized format so that we know what those assets look like and how to best use them. We also work in a program, have a collection of programs that seek to take those data and make them more useful to policymakers, educators, lay people, since GIS technology is a little bit foreboding and the data itself doesn't really provide sometimes the kind of insight that is needed for policy analysis. And the decision support programs divide into two areas. One is a collection of services called DataNet or DataNet Web. It's a web-based warehouse for mostly census data and other socioeconomic data. It provides some functions that allow individuals, policymakers, analysts to extract and compile custom reports, business graphics type things, charts and things like that, and maps on demand about population, population change, population characteristics and things of that sort. It will satisfy about 250,000 requests for those kinds of services in FY05. And then we also leveraged some of the early software development, the intellectual property that Minnesota owns the rights to build custom software that is usually packaged with these data assets and allows non-technical people to be able to map things like land use and environmental conditions and soils characteristics and weather patterns and population change and things of that sort. It's now being, latest version of that has now been adopted by educators around the state with their help. It was actually designed with their help and is being deployed in schools around the state in part to help satisfy the new social geography component of the social studies standard. Finally, we offer professional GIS services primarily for state agencies on a fee-for-service basis. This activity is about 80% of our revenues are from clients that are other state agencies. We really don't go seek clients beyond that domain. Our role, we actually provide those services to state agencies that have GIS, like the DNR and NDOT, for specialized projects that they either require a short-term engagement or require some specialized skills that we possess and they may not be able to bring to bear on a specific project. DNR, MnDOT, the PCA, the Department of Health, Homeland Security, Revenue, they've all been clients of ours in the last year. We do about 35 to 40 projects a year. It's demand-driven, so if we don't do well, do good work, we don't get the work. But we've run that operation now ever since we were created in 77. Our staff now varies from 5 to 7, depending on demand. If demand goes up, we need to be flexible enough to bring people in to support those projects. But right now, we're projecting revenues of about $650,000 to $680,000 a year over the next 2 years. And that's entirely self-supporting. And the work that we do ranges from GIS project design to web mapping applications. We often help other agencies establish their own GIS programs and then provide the coordination support for them. So how are we going to adjust to this change in our operations? How are our operations going to adjust to the $837,000 reduction, which will reduce our FTE complement from about 8.5 to about 1.75? What we're seeking to do as creatively as possible is to identify the essential core services that are described in the budget and then supplement them with grants and contracts as best we can. And hopefully we'll be able to at least sustain our core activities. However, it's going to be a serious challenge. I don't want to distract you from that issue. We are working very hard and creatively to meet the challenge, but we will be reducing our staff support for coordination services from about 2 FTEs to about 0.5 FTE. We're going to maintain support. The governor is committed to maintaining support for the Governor's Council on Geographic Information, which he recognizes is an important component of the infrastructure that supports other agencies and organizations around the state, but we will probably do relatively little else in terms of liaisoning with federal agencies and other agencies. We just won't have the resources. The Data Clearinghouse services will be continued. As they exist, we won't be doing outreach with it, but we will be focusing our efforts on maintaining our web services since they are up and running. So long as we don't change them, they should continue to operate. But we won't be doing much beyond that. The decision support programs will be eliminated. We'll be eliminating the three FTEs connected with that unless we can find some other source of support. That means that the DataNet program will be sustained as a web operation, I suppose, until it breaks. That could be forever, but we won't be adding new data sources to it. And we will be eliminating our support for our GIS software, although it will continue to be available until we run out of the ability to make copies of them. And the GIS consulting program will continue unchanged. There will be relatively little to impact that operation. This is basically summarizes the effect, but actually I need to correct the numbers here. This was put together hastily at the last minute, but the budget breakdown for the first two lines, those are actually one-year figures, and the GIS consulting service number is actually a two-year figure. So I don't know what the math ends. I guess we need to add another $258,000 to the bottom line. But on an annual basis, it'll be about $57,000 for the coordination effort, about $201,000 for the clearinghouse effort, none for the decision support effort, and the consulting services activity will be self-supporting through contracts and fees. So that's the end of my presentation. I'll be happy to address any questions as best I can.
Thank you for the presentation. I think what we'll do, we have a series of people here who would like to weigh in on the LIMIC funding, and some of those folks are from out of town, so I think what we'd like to do is have them come give testimony briefly, because we do have a huge docket today. But anyone who is here, I have Tina Rosenstein. Okay, if you could come down, and then if anybody wants to come down that's not on the list, you're welcome, but we'll try to keep your comments contained and not duplicative if that's possible. Brad Scheib, Bob Lockyer, Larry Charbonneau, and Brad Henry. So anybody who would like to say something, or if Ms. Rosenstein, if you are kind of the spokesperson for the group, that's great. But anybody who would like to come testify that's on the list, come on down. And then we need you to sign in on the sign-in sheet that's at your desk up front there, too. You just introduce yourself and your title and then give us your testimony. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Tina Rosenstein, and I'm the Environmental Services Director for Nicollet County in Minnesota. I've been with the county for 13 years now, and we handle planning and zoning in the county. And I'm speaking on behalf mostly for the Minnesota Association of County Planning and Zoning Administrators, and they have prepared a resolution in support of continued funding for the Local Planning Assistance Center. And that's what I'd like to speak to. We all use LIMIC quite a bit because of their GIS capabilities and their ability to help us with our work. But the Minnesota Local Planning Assistance Center, which is about a $300,000 a year program, has served so many counties, particularly in the outstate area that may not have a huge staff to assist them in their planning efforts. This has been a huge help to us in getting our programs done, getting our comprehensive programs completed, working on the all-hazard mitigation planning, which the federal government has been requiring us to prepare. And they have just been invaluable in their work with counties. They work with cities, townships, individual citizens. You know, I'm not sure it's well understood just how broad their reach is out into the communities, but certainly for counties, they've been just incredible support to us getting our jobs done and doing the work. I think for the amount of money that it costs the state to provide this service to virtually every governmental unit and every citizen in the state is well worth the minimal amount of funding that they require. And there is to have that professional assistance. Not all counties have well-trained planners on board, but this just gives that expertise that they need to do a good job and prevent the kinds of problems that not having good planning goes with development and keeping economic development happening. So that's a short and sweet plea to continue funding of this center, and if there's any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them. I'd like to hand out the copy of the resolution, if I may.
Sure, thank you. We have a page that'll come forward and hand that out.
Great.
I'm not sure. We did the LIMIC presentation. We have the Local Planning Assistance Center elimination portion of the budget next. I'm not sure who's from admin who's going to be doing that, but maybe we'll... Would you like to go first to explain what you're doing and then maybe have the testifiers come up? If I thought the people who are signed up were all talking about LIMIC. Is there anybody who wants to talk only about LIMIC that's in the audience? Okay, why don't we have you come forward first, and then we'll get back to the Planning Assistance Center. Ma'am, I didn't specify we were just going to do LIMIC. So if we could have the LIMIC testifiers come forward now, and then we'll go through the Planning Assistance Center from admin, and then we'll bring the people in who want to testify on that.
Thank you.
If that makes any sense. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Larry Charbonneau. I am the president of the Lawrence Group, which is a private sector mapping company, GIS mapping company here in the metro area. And I come from a plea from the private sector as to the value of LIMIC and its data resources to us from the GIS community. One good example is recently LIMIC helped negotiate the coordination between the Department of Agriculture and the Pollution Control to have the FSA photos throughout the state available to us from a private sector availability. And we published the King Street Atlas in the Twin Cities, and it's invaluable to us to have data, photos, photographs like that to update plats and subdivisions to make our mapping as accurate as possible. If we would have had to buy that particular set of photographs, it would have been too expensive for us to do. So just from that perspective, from my private sector point of view, LIMIC has been very valuable to us. We also are the purveyor and provider of a street centerline data throughout the now becoming 25-county metropolitan area. And we provide that data to all public and state agencies throughout the state at no cost through an arrangement with the Metropolitan Council. Again, those photographs help us keep that data up to date, and all of the various public agencies throughout the state can download that data from the Metropolitan Council. So we play a large role in the Twin Cities, and it was the help of LIMIC and some of the data that we use there that's really made our business more successful from a private sector perspective. Any questions I could answer?
Are there questions for this testifier? Representative Holberg?
Yes. As we looked at the different sections of LIMIC that the administration went forward with or came with, which of those sections, I guess maybe they're up there, would the businesses be using? Is it the decision support or...
The data clearinghouse is an area where we use quite a bit of information from them. And the GIS consulting services, we are also a GIS firm, but there are areas where that we can work with LIMIC in it from a GIS perspective as well. And I think that that is an area that, if it was not here, would be something that we would find.
Well, Mr. Chairman, sir, I think the GIS consulting program, as I understand, is self-supporting
yes.
from fees, but the other two or the other three services are not. The decision support, as I understand it, would be eliminated completely, and the GIS software would not be updated. Is that the information that I had from the Department of Administration? And how would that, if that is the case, how would that affect your
if that business. Affects us in from our perspective of getting the not having the availability of aerial photography coverage and some of that data, it would affect us greatly from a private sector perspective.
And Mr. Chairman, the obvious question, would the private sector be willing to pay for this?
Mr. Charbonneau?
Is it enough value for you to pay for it?
It could be considered, yes, it could be considered. If you have to pay for photography coverage in its great nature and what's been available to us, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we certainly couldn't afford to do that. But if there were a group of us, and I think you'll hear from some more of us from the private sector, on how this has helped us, yes, I think that there would be an opportunity for us to do that.
Okay. Any other questions for this witness? All right. Anyone else on LMIC that would like to come forward and testify? We'll have you come. If you want to come down, if there's more people with LMIC, just come on down. We'll have you come in groups of two. Just in the interest of time, we have a pretty aggressive docket that we need to get through this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you this morning. My name is Brad Henry. I'll give you a real quick overview of who I am, what I feel the value of GIS has been to the community, and then also the value of LMIC. My background is that I was an engineer for the city of Minneapolis for 31 years, and now I'm over in the private sector with URS. I've been an engineer there for 5 years, and I also am an instructor at the University of Minnesota on this subject. My friends in the community also refer to me as the GIS evangelist, but I'll try not to convince you today about the value of GIS, too much at least. In Minneapolis, we had quite a few significant usages of GIS. For example, at the, when I left the city of Minneapolis, well over 250,000 products every single year were created using this technology. We also saw how we could use it to streamline the enterprise. Kathy O'Brien, our city coordinator, could clearly see the silos between departments needed to be broken down. GIS was an ideal vehicle to be able to do that. In public works, we were able to dramatically increase our productivity, and the key was the point that David mentioned, 80% of the cost of a GIS is basically in the data or the map. By sharing this, by breaking down those barriers across silos, we became much more efficient. Those of you who read the paper remember in the early 90s, Minneapolis was starting to be referred to as Murderopolis. Minneapolis actually used GIS to more efficiently and effectively manage the policing force in the city to dramatically decrease crime in the city. And then my last few years at the city of Minneapolis, I worked with David and other people in the GIS community making Metro GIS available. Over in the private sector, we at URS were a large transportation and engineering firm. For example, in the design-build arena, which MnDOT is rolling out extensively now to streamline the delivery of service, GIS is essential to help us get mapping data over into that engineering arena to speed up delivery. Right now, we're actually working on the Metro evacuation plan. Step one was to go out to the data clearinghouse, see what data is available to help us create that plan, and then go to Metro GIS to help get that data. Also in the homeland security environment, absolutely essential to have that data. And right now what we work on is very high-end GIS, which enables us to actually show people like you who aren't acquainted with the engineering details how engineering solutions in BRT, hot lanes, etc., design build will help you help solve transportation problems. At the University of Minnesota, I help to teach people, or engineers in particular, the basics of GIS and the value of GIS, but probably most importantly, what we try to get across, this idea of how can you use this tool to be successful. And I think the key word that we try to get across in that class is the value of collaboration, coordination, which then brings me to the value of LMIC to the community. As a matter of fact, at our next class, not this week, but next week, collaboration actually is going to be the subject. And the message is really those who undertake GIS on their own aren't doing it efficiently and effectively. That, I believe, is the most important value that David and his organization brings to the community, their understanding of GIS and their value, understanding the value of collaboration, working together, not reinventing the wheel. So it is ironic as GIS gets spread out in the public sector and the private sector community, and it becomes aware that how valuable this tool is. I think we don't want to misunderstand the value of that LMIC provides in GIS coordination and collaboration in this data clearinghouse role. So on that, I'll complete my comments, and if I get any questions, I'd make an attempt to answer them.
Any questions for this witness? Okay, thank you for coming down. We'll have, and you can come down and two people can sit at the table at once if you'd like, just for timeliness. And then we need everybody to sign in as well. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for allowing me this morning to testify against the proposed budget cut for LIMIC. My name is David Gorg. I'm speaking to you this morning as a retired MnDOT surveying and mapping engineer. I retired from that agency about 3 years ago. And currently, I'm working as a part-time engineer for a small mapping firm, Martinez Corporation, located in Eagan. I began working with LIMIC about 1980 when a number of us that were in state, federal, and local government, we started seeing a need for collaboration and standardization of all this mapping data. And this was before the term GIS came about, but we could see it coming and the importance of working together. Well, LIMIC stepped forward and performed that critical role of coordinating, facilitating all of us to work together. I don't think it would have happened without them being in place and willing to do that. I cannot emphasize enough the importance of having them as a facilitator to have us all work with the standards, agree to them, and to facilitate the collaboration. In the last 20 years of my career at MnDOT, I did have the opportunity to participate in national committees dealing with surveying and mapping, go to conferences that provided the technical, the research and development and so on. And we always, many times I heard the comments from the other states, why is it working so well in Minnesota? You know, why doesn't it work that way in our state? And the answer I would give them is because we all worked together, we knew each other's needs, we could all have a common vision for where we wanted to be, and LIMIC was in the middle of making that happen. So other states didn't have that opportunity, or if they did, they didn't choose to take advantage of it. So that's how we got to where we're at today. Now today, more and more money is being spent, more than ever. We need accurate mapping. When we have a natural disaster, or we have an act of terrorism, or some other emergency response, we're going to need good, current, accurate mapping that follows standards and is available for all of us as taxpayers to use. So I think today it's critical that we do fund them adequately to perform their job, and we will all benefit as taxpayers. Thank you, and if I can answer any questions, I would try to do that.
Questions for this witness? Okay, sir, if you want to go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm David Claypool, the Ramsey County Surveyor. With the gray hair, I've been in it since 1985, and David is right. We used to call it LIS. Didn't become GIS until after we all began to work on it for a few years. I was a member of the original Governor's Council on GIS, and I was one of the first chairs of the Minnesota GIS Consortium. And I'm an active member of Metro GIS. I sit on a couple of national committees. I've been asked to sit on both the National Cadastral Committee because of my experience here in Minnesota as a Minnesotan, and also the NACO GIS Committee. Now, having said that, I'm going to get off my notes because everything has been said basically already. I'm going to make a couple of points. One is that under David Arbeid's direction, we have really been sailing as a group of collaborative people. One of the problems that Minnesota has is that we participate at the national level. Now, when I participate with people from LIMIC at a national level, it's in committees, and it's also under contracts with the federal government, like when we work with tribal lawsuits and things like that having to do with the U.S. Justice Department. And in every case, we show up good for Minnesota. Very, very good. We have another issue in Minnesota that on the FGDC, the Federal Geographic Data Committee, and other subcommittees of that, where they have funds that we could get here in Minnesota, it's very difficult because we're so well working independently with each other as collaboratives that we don't have a point of reference. LIMIC needs to be our point of reference. And I'd also like to say one other thing. I'd like to say that in 1985, when I put that first county GIS together, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but LIMIC was totally functioning under a PEAS. In other words, they couldn't work with us unless they had a contract with us. They were in competition and conflict with themselves. They were in competition and conflict with me at Ramsey County trying to do things I needed to do, and it was not a good deal. And since they've been able to have a budget to put people together to work, we have really gone a long ways. And I want to say that collaborative effort is it. Brad Henry used one of my quotes. He didn't give me credit for it, but that's okay. We've all worked together for years. We're very good at what we do, and LMIC is part of that. It is an integral part of what Minnesota is doing. And if anyone would like to ask any particular questions or see any kind of a informational thing on this, we'd be more than happy to show you that at some other time. Are there any questions?
Representative Pam? No. Anybody else have to
run
through this list? Okay. Next, go ahead.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for letting me testify today. My name is Jed Beecher. I'm been the website administrator at MnDOT for the last 6 years, but I'm here today as a private citizen. I have worked at LMIC in the past. I've worked at the DNR, also at Olmsted County Planning. And I just wanted to reiterate some of the things that have been brought up today. I've seen the benefits of the coordination that LMIC provides, the data sets that they have helped produce or acquire that just wouldn't have happened otherwise. A lot of the statewide data sets that are created are they're created in a way that benefits multiple GIS players in the state, whereas if an organization such as the DNR developed a data set, it would be geared towards natural resources. If MnDOT does it, it's geared towards highways and roads. But if all those players are brought together, it's created in such a way so that everybody can use it and share. So they've created invaluable resources for counties, smaller bodies of government that would never be able to provide some of this data for themselves to use because of its cost. So the biggest thing I see is the coordination, bringing everyone together, and going after federal dollars that are available. The partnerships that LMIC is able to utilize. And then lastly, I also worked on that local planning assistance group that's coming up next. And having worked at a larger county like Olmsted County for a couple summers as an intern, but I really saw the level of expertise that a large county like Olmsted had to bear on planning problems. But then when I was on the local planning team, we were helping Dodge County right next to Olmsted, and it was very clear that there was the expertise just isn't there. And it was very advantageous to small counties and local bodies of government to be able to draw on that state expertise, and I think that's really critical when there is so much growth and pressure of growth on local bodies of government, and they need these kind of state resources to pull on, as well as all of the GIS information that LMIC provides these local bodies of government can utilize. That's all I had to say. Thank you. Any questions for me?
Any questions from members? Okay, is there anyone who wants to testify on the LMIC portion of the budget that already has not, whatever hasn't been said, or if you have anything to add? Representative Kahn?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make some comments on this. Actually, I'm sorry I missed the initial preparation, but I have a very long familiarity with this organization, which actually started as an LCMR grant, which people ought to think about when you look at the governor's proposal to just turn that over to hunting and fishing groups and citizen impacts, to think how likely one would be to start something like this 30 years ago, when no one thought about information systems as important. And I just think this is one of the, you know, I know I should get more emotional about sick people being dropped from MnCare and not adequate supply in nursing homes and education not sufficiently supported. But this is one of the critical parts of what I'd like to call the intellectual infrastructure of the state. And one of the things, and you know, I think Representative Solberg started to ask the question about, well, would all these people who say it's so useful pay for it? The problem with building up a basic information structure is that there's no, it's like, in economics, it's like the lighthouse phenomena. I mean, everybody benefits from having a lighthouse at the entrance to a port, but nobody benefits enough. You know, it's whether you pay for it or not, it's there, and you benefit from it. And those kinds of things, like as we're looking at bioscience development and the economics related to that, if you don't have the basic science that's been done by universities, by NIH, by the national federal labs and state labs and agriculture departments, you know, the value-added product is not available. So I really consider that probably in our division, I consider this is one of the most important cuts that we need to find some way of restoring. And I'm actually kind of surprised that the administration picked on something I think that had, it's easy to pick on because it has no political saliency. None of your individual citizens are going to be calling you saying that this is something that's important to their lives. But, you know, it's one of the things that I think it's our responsibility to see that it's continued.
Okay. Representative DeLaForest, did you have anything to say on this? Or?
Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I just wonder if I could ask just a couple brief questions of the original witness.
The admin department?
Yes.
Okay. Could admin come back up and then the people who are going to be presenting the next portion, which is the Local Planning Assistance Center, if you want to come forward and get ready, and then Representative DeLaForest is going to ask this witness a couple questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I listened to all the witnesses, a couple questions were raised in my mind, and it appears to me that the public and private sector entities are taking advantage of the resources that are offered by LMIC, and I'm wondering if you just have any numbers, maybe a percentage breakdown as to people who take advantage of your services between public and private sector.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative LaForest, the best indication that we have are through web logs that we maintain in terms of data downloads, and I really don't have the data in front of me, but as I recall, I mean, a general profile is about 85-90% public sector. Largely out-state counties around the state. The FSA photography that was referenced earlier is a good example. We first put that online about 9 months ago, and within just a couple of weeks of the announcement, the data downloads coming from the web actually increased by about 6 or 7-fold. And most of those requests were coming from small counties, not in the metro, but outstate, being used for some of their natural resources and emergency management programs. And we also get quite a few from some MNSCU campuses. The number of private sector downloads is probably in the order of, if I had to just put a ballpark figure of it, maybe 15 or 20%. But of those, I know many of them come from consultants like ProWest, which is the principal consultant for counties in outstate Minnesota in terms of implementing their GIS programs. So it's hard to really assess what the breakdown would be.
Representative DeLaForest.
Just a final question, Mr. Chairman. And are there any private sector businesses that do that you're aware of? I mean, are they out there offering this in any type of way? I imagine that even if they are, you obviously have different economies of scale. For example, it might be worthwhile for a private sector company to map Hennepin County as opposed to maybe Kitson County. I'm just curious as to what's out there to the best of your knowledge.
Yeah, there are many private sector companies that do that. In most cases, they're offering a level of detail in the data that they develop that are suited to local applications, very, very microscopic applications, engineering functions. Mr. Henry talked about some of that. His company does some of that work. Mr. Gorg's company does some of that kind of work. But this is complementary data. And I would say, you know, referring to that earlier question, as 80% of the cost of GIS is really in the data, as we're seeing counties across the state, and most counties now have begun to adopt GIS, the reason that they've been able to do that is that they build on top of the data that are available from us. That's sort of the foundation.
One final question, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Just another question was sparked in my mind. At some point, will we not see costs go down for this service? I mean, there is only so much land. You know, God isn't making more, and we can map it a number of different ways. But but not to the best of my knowledge, he's not making any more representative.
Well, Representative LaForest, the problem is people are mucking it up more and more. So the information is more useful.
Coming from a district that builds about 500 to 600 new homes every year, Representative Kahn, I see it.
Actually, within a half mile of my house, I think that figure is probably very underestimated.
In any case, Mr. Chairman, my question is, I mean, don't costs go down? I mean, Representative Kahn touched on some of the initial startup costs, and I think of, for example, in my professional life, brokering commercial real estate, we have a private sector database we use called Excelligent, and I'm sure there were some high initial startup costs, but now the program is fairly much on autopilot and things get added or taken off, and you know, I pay $330 a year for the privilege of accessing it. My question simply is, aren't costs going to go down as we move forward and accumulate this database?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative LaForest, costs have been going down, and in fact, the costs of our operations have been going down. Our budget, actually in real dollars, since I sort of came here as limit director in '94, is about 40% less than what it was when I arrived. And when I arrived, we were delivering at our peak 120 data sets a year. Now we're doing 6,000 a month. The cost per unit is dramatically down. The issue here is that the use of the services is greatly expanded and is still on the exponential portion of the growth curve. It's not just about land as well. The data, if it were just about land, even in that case, the data needs to be refreshed periodically. If you're in the real estate industry, you know that every transaction changes the database. The infrastructure is in place. Our basic infrastructure is in place. But we're still sort of working to acquire, commit organizations to standards so that our data can work together, to develop partnerships with other organizations. And in some cases, as with the aerial photography, that needs to be refreshed periodically as the landscape changes. Otherwise, we can't really detect the changes on the landscape, especially as new subdivisions happen and that sort of thing.
Okay. We need to move on to the next portion because we do have some testifiers from out of town. This is the Local Planning Assistance Center. If we'd go back and have the admin folks present. This is an elimination item, I believe.
Okay.
And go ahead and introduce yourself again.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Good morning. You bet.
I just wanted to point out one of the handouts that was passed out before we started, which is just a brief summary of LIMIC and the budget impact in each of the four categories. It's sort of an at-a-glance summary just for your use.
Okay.
And we have Deb Pyle here who will do an overview of the, go ahead, of the Local Planning Assistance Center.
Good morning. I'm Deborah Pyle with the Local Planning Assistance Center. I'm the director of the center. Thank you for inviting me here today. The Local Planning Assistance Center is slated to be eliminated. Our budget is $299,000. As noted, the center was established in 97. You'll notice in your detailed information, however, that the function itself was a function of the State Planning Agency from its inception in the mid-60s, essentially to provide local governments with assistance in dealing with comprehensive planning, zoning, development and change issues. The center itself, this current reincarnation came into about with the passage of the Community-Based Planning Act. At that time, there was state money available the first time in 20 years for grants for planning. We coupled that with the technical assistance effort, and at that time had a staff of about seven people. Right now, the center has three people plus a volunteer. We've been fortunate to have a volunteer almost full-time with the group for the last 4 years, supplementing our effort. The technical assistance is something that we continued and was recognized by local governments as some of them said, even more important than getting a grant, having the information available. The technical assistance monies came from the state as special appropriations or as one-time appropriations in 98, 99, and 2000, and then a base level increase was given to the planning agency in 2002 to continue that technical assistance effort. The mission of the Local Planning Assistance Center is to provide assistance, data, and advice to help local governments as they prepare plans, essentially comprehensive plans, as they address land use and development issues. And we also help them to use GIS in decision making. You've heard about the various GIS information that's out there. What we do is help people to know how to use it. We help people prepare the plans. We don't write plans. The state's not in the business of writing plans or writing ordinances. Essentially, a plan has to be written at the local level. It has to be something that's generated by local communities in order for it to really have any meaning for them. What we do is give them the information so that they have the ability to do the planning themselves. Many communities around the state are dealing with development pressures, and there are also a lot of communities that are dealing with decline and decay, infrastructure that's not serving their needs at all anymore. The planning issues and the problems they face vary throughout the state, but many of the communities face those things. We try with the GIS information to make people aware of what's available, what they can use, so that they can take full advantage of that information in their decision making, full information. Our clients are townships, cities, counties, regional development commissions, and citizens. Essentially, it's the small places. Mainly, it's communities outside the metropolitan area. As was mentioned earlier, most of the larger cities in the metropolitan area or counties have planning staff. They have experts they can draw on. When you get outside the metro area to the smaller places, this is often not the case. And in fact, they might have no staff, they might have a part-time staff, or they might have a staff person that's wearing many different hats and can be fairly overwhelmed by just the day-to-day information. We provide that sort of staff expertise for them. So as an issue arises, they can come to us for information when they need it. In an average year, we would assist more than 250 cities, counties, and townships throughout the state with more than 450 requests. So we get repeat users. When people have used our service, they come back for more. We also have more than 40,000 web hits a year. We're trying more and more to put our information on the web so that for the basic question, the community can just go right there and get what they need when they need it, and then they can request further assistance from us for the more complex issues. We also help regional development commissions. We work in partnership with them throughout the state. That way they can really do the outreach right to the unit of government, helping them prepare a plan or an ordinance. But we can do that background research to gather ideas for them, to make sure that people in one part of the state are aware of what's happened in another part of the state. Benefit from that information. Some of the things that we provide, sample documents, sample ordinances, sample plans, resolutions, can be as simple as a community wanting to start planning and develop a planning commission, and they just want an example of what kind of resolution do we put together to even do such a thing. Quick access to research and practical solutions. It's not uncommon to get a call from a local unit of government about an issue that's coming up before their board or council the next week, and they really need some quick ideas on how this issue maybe has been handled in another part of the state. We produce documents to help people through planning processes. One of our most recent ones under construction is a step-by-step guide for local planning, for comprehensive planning. It breaks the process down, gives communities ideas on questions to ask, data to collect, where to get it, how to get help. It's available on the web by for a download. This is being used by hundreds of communities around the state. It was our way to try to put together a lot of the individual questions people were asking and have a way to get it out quickly. Another item that we prepared recently was the Careful County All-Hazard Mitigation Plan. This is a fake county, Careful County. Counties throughout the state and throughout the country are required by FEMA to prepare hazard mitigation plans. This is sort of the front-end side of that emergency response that you heard some reference to earlier. This is the planning that's done to ensure that when a disaster hits, it's not as bad. So you're really doing that pre-planning for the disasters. We prepared, no one had ever done one of these in the country, so we prepared a plan for a fake county that then counties in Minnesota can use as their guide as they're trying to put together their plan. And again, we put all these things on disks and on the web and packaged with data, mining that information from LMIC that can help the community with their planning. We have also information packets, so we put those together based on requests to try to quickly answer questions. We have packets on more than 30 different topics. This one is on moratorium. We have things on eminent domain, subdivisions, all the basic questions that people have. This pulls together articles, examples from communities around the state and other parts of the country. People can just order this on the web and get their questions answered quickly. And finally, we give training and presentations. Our training is generally in cooperation with local government associations or regional development commissions, others, so that we can reach large groups of people. We give presentations primarily in areas without regional development commissions to county boards, city councils that are starting in a planning process. Alternatives, with the elimination of the center, we do have a very extensive library of materials. It's probably the most extensive in the state that's available for use. We're looking to have that collection relocated to another spot with one of our partners so that people can continue to have access to those materials. Some of the partners that we work with, listed here, consultants, nonprofits, Metropolitan Council, Regional Development Commissions, and the associations, may be able to fill some of the niche that we fill. However, none is really in a position to offer that statewide assistance, nor the kind of economy of scale or transfer of information from one part of the state to another that a central operation is able to do. Thank you for your time.
Good, thank you. Do we have questions for this witness, or... perhaps we'll have you hold on and we'll have some testifiers come down. Sarah Erickson and Kent Sullum are here on the testifier list. I didn't know if there was anyone else that was planning on testifying on this. We'll try to keep the testimony brief and non-duplicative if that's possible. And just introduce yourself and any position you hold and proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Bob Locke here. I'm a private consulting planner and here today as a planner and a private citizen. A comment on what I consider this disturbing proposal in the government's budget. In my 36 years as a planner, I've worked in three states and four levels of government. During that time, I've always depended on guidance from the state to help set standards of practice and coordination for progressive planning. It was this thoughtful and progressive planning that originally attracted me to come to Minnesota back in the late 70s. I'm here today to urge you to consider carefully the potential harm that you will do to many communities that do not have the political clout of the Big Brothers if you eliminate the Local Planning Assistance Center program. I'm now retired from 25 years as the planner for Washington County, and I spend my time working to help small communities develop a vision of what they want to be in the future, a plan to accomplish those goals, and some techniques to implement them. State planning assistance has always been helpful and necessary to provide current, relevant, and coordinated information to help coordinate to the success of the many municipalities and communities with which I've worked. I have personally used this valuable tool as I have gone about the business of training local government planning commissions. I think that a good example of their work is that document, Under Construction. It's a how-to book on planning, and I use it frequently to illustrate the benefit of planning ahead and to leave communities with valuable information and a contact for help if and when needed. Now, the governor has stated that these communities can just hire a consultant. Well, I'm here to tell you that there's just not enough consultants to do all the work that needs to be done. And in addition, often, the state LPAC program is the last stop a community can make if they just don't have the wherewithal to hire a consultant to address some of their major planning issues. As times have changed and the planning process has become more complex, Minnesota's Local Planning Assistance Group has been there to help provide guidance to these communities in planning for the future. It's been said that if you have no plan, then anywhere you wind up is okay. The Minnesota LPAC program is aimed at helping prevent this lack of preparing for the future in our municipalities. Don't take away the only help that some of our communities depend on. Continue to fund the LPAC, and let's continue Minnesota's tradition of progressive planning. Thank you, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for this witness? Okay, if we could have the next two people come down and have a seat, that way you don't have to stand while you're waiting. Just introduce yourself and any position you have. Morning.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. I, too, would like to strongly encourage that this committee reinstate the funding for the local planning assistance program. The $300,000 that it's required to budget this program is perhaps one of the most cost-effective and efficient uses of state money there is. If you look at the first slide that they presented on the budget principles that the department and the administration used to try to determine their budget cuts, I would have to argue that eliminating the LPAC program violates every last one of these principles. I know it's not an easy thing for a department to try to have to find the cuts and in this day and age of very limited financing make the tough decisions. But if you look at the focus on fundamentals, well, hopefully by now it's clear to this committee that good planning should be a very fundamental aspect of what the state is providing in terms of assistance to local government. With stormwater, wastewater, impaired waters, and feedlots just being a handful of the very controversial issues that you're dealing with this session, it's hopefully very clear that at the local level that's going to require a lot more planning work, and we need unbiased, good central information that is provided through the LPAC program. Minimize the reductions that would pass costs to others. Well, by eliminating this program, 100% of the costs are being passed on to local governments. Assure the best value. $300,000 providing statewide benefit that is being used by hundreds of communities, townships, cities, and counties alike, helping us coordinate our efforts, helping us do good outreach and planning, has to be one of the best values for the dollar, which also shows that is one of the most cost-effective means of providing assistance to the local level. Looking very quickly at the alternatives listed, providing that consultants, well, as you already heard, there are not that many consultants out there, and in the rural areas, if we had to use consultants from the very start, they're a very important tool, and we encourage our members to use private consultants. But if they can get a lot of the base work done, a lot of the research done using the LPAC program, you save tremendously on the cost because those consultants, while valuable, are not cheap. Nonprofits and advocacy organizations tend to be very biased in the information. It's important to get their input, but relying on them to develop your plan as a sole source of information tends to be rather dangerous for our members because you get very biased information that gets us into trouble. The Met Council does not help rural Minnesota, and it changes every 4 years anyhow, so you have very inconsistent information being provided. And the RDCs. There are only 10 RDCs out of the 12 districts in the state of Minnesota. And out of those, the 10 that are functioning, there's very mixed results. Some are fantastic to work with. Others, we actually have had to come in the past to have the state contact RDCs to say, yes, you will provide assistance to townships, you will provide assistance to the rural members, and not just the large core cities. And finally, the state associations such as ours, The Minnesota Association of Townships works very closely with the LPAC program. They provide us with lectures. They provide us with tools that we can disseminate to our members, and therefore it's a very good partnership. There's not a duplication of efforts. It's a complementary program to what the associations do. So I hope that even though we are in tough fiscal straits, that you can find the $300,000 to provide this very efficient and effective program on an ongoing basis. Thank you.
Very good. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Sarah Erickson. I represent the Minnesota Association of Small Cities. Nancy Larson is our executive director, and she couldn't be here today, so I'm testifying on her behalf. Minnesota Association of Small Cities represents cities throughout Minnesota with populations of 5,000 or less. We are opposed to the governor's funding cuts for the Local Planning Assistance Center. The center provides our small cities with much-needed comprehensive planning and zoning information. It assists our cities who don't have the financial or personnel resources to conduct the much-needed long-term planning, thereby allowing our cities to grow. LPIC offers technical assistance, data and strategic planning advice to our small cities, and it is important for our cities, especially in rural Minnesota, to have the resources to grow and develop in an orderly and sustainable fashion. I'd like to thank the committee for taking the time to hear our testimony today.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for this witness? Representative Kahn.
Maybe a general question to all of the witnesses from these counties. Do you think it would be more useful to have this program retained or the proposed faith-based initiatives, which are the next thing on the line?
Do you want to wait until that presentation's done? You probably don't know enough about it yet.
Yeah.
Same with me, Representative Kahn. I'm not fully informed and ready to vote on that yet. Let's have the next witness come forward and introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Annalie Garlitz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I also work with the Minnesota Association of County Planning and Zoning Administrators, whose resolution was passed out earlier by Ms. Rosenson. AMC and McPisa support continued funding for the Planning Assistance Center. The center provides valuable assistance for counties and other local units of government to help them carry out their planning activities. For counties and other small units of government, the access to this information is not always... A lot of places have lots of staff with expertise and other staff members who can carry this out, but some counties, as noted before, don't have these staff resources available to them. So the center, as Mr. Sloan from Township said, does not duplicate work. It's complementary to these areas. Without access to these resources, there are many counties that will struggle with planning, to get planning questions answered, and they will need to compile this data internally, which is often, like I said, a struggle when there's not a lot of staff available. Very difficult in places. If consulting firms were needed to be obtained for this, there's not a lot of funding for that in places that they don't have a lot of staff and they don't have a lot of funding to hire consulting firms. In closing, I just want to restate that the Local Planning Assistance Center provides a valuable resource to the state and that counties benefit greatly from. Thank you very much. And I can take any questions.
Do we have any questions for this witness?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Solberg?
Not for all of them, but can I admonish you to kind of gavel so that we can have the witnesses have the respect that they need?
Conversations on a little bit, if we could.
And then my other question is to all of the witnesses, when the LEMIC, or this particular service, LPAC, is planning to put their resources in the RDCs, how much of an access would they get from RDCs? Who would be able to access them? How would they be able to be accessed if at all? And so at some point I'd like to have that.
Is there someone
question.
From the RDC? Are you here from the RDC?
I am not from the RDC, no.
Can you answer it?
No, maybe.
I can answer the question. I just wanted to, the reason I'm back here is not to stands or grandstand. But Brad Scheib, the vice president of the Minnesota chapter of the American Planning Association, was supposed to be here, but he had a meeting conflict.
Okay.
Called me this morning and just said he is sending a letter, and I just wanted to get that into the record.
Okay, and I do have him on the docket. Thank you.
Yeah,
I appreciate that.
He's not here because he had a conflict, and he is sending a letter. With respect to the question and answer to the representative's issue with about RDCs, they're already working at full capacity, and it just makes it much more available if it's coordinated at a state level rather than in individual districts. It's difficult enough to get the right information to the people without a lot of different interpretations, and I think that all we're doing is diluting it if we don't have some kind of coordination. I think when they discussed the LMIC issues, they were talking about the benefit of having one organization that's really kind of heading up with respect to setting planning or their standards. I think we're doing the same thing here with planning standards.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe the Department of Administration can answer the question as well. But I noticed on their slide that they said relocate the library and resource materials to an RDC. I guess to, I don't know if it's a RDC or other partner. Then is that the RDC? Is one of them going to have all the material, and are they expected to be provide the access or?
From admin be able to tell us what the plan is for that, or
Mr. Chairman, Representative Deborah Pyle again with the Local Planning Assistance Center. The specifics of the relocation have not been worked out. Our goal is to ensure that the collection of materials stays together because it is really a unique, valuable collection library of local planning assistance materials, very expensive. So we've been in discussions with various people, including regional development commissions, about a possible home for this library. As to the availability of the materials to other parties, that has not been worked out. Traditionally, an RDC will, a regional development commission, will function within its region. There's, I don't believe, a precedent for one to offer services more broadly than that. We're also looking at possible university locations as well.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you just want to keep the information together and put it in the in library form, put it in the historical warehouse. I mean, that then it's together, but it doesn't do any good.
Chair, members of the committee, in response to Representative Solberg's question and the department's reply, unless that information is kept together in an accessible location for all cities, counties, and townships, you might as well just shred the information because it becomes useless. Trying to distribute it among 10 RDCs would leave very fractured information, at least two regions of the state without any access. Trying to coordinate into one RDC, I think you'd have some disagreement as to which RDC would be the best recipient. Representative Solberg, I think you happen to be from an area where we have two very effective and well-used RDCs, which I could say the same for all parts of the state, but that simply isn't true, at least for my members. So we'd have great concern about it being at the RDC level just because it isn't a universal, uniform method of disseminating information to the members.
Well, one question I have, how big is this resource area? I mean, we say library. Is it as big as this room? Is it as big as this horseshoe or smaller than that, as big as the desk?
Mr. Chairman, I would say it's half the size of your horseshoe.
Okay. Any other questions on this? We're going to try to plow through the technology, Office of Technology, and try to get through Drive to Excellence, and try to get through Drive to Excellence faith-based initiatives. If we get the reverse auction, that would be tremendous, but Office of Technology is next. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Keith Payton. I am the
Deputy Commissioner for Department of Administration. I also serve as the state CIO, and most recently have been the project lead for the Drive to Excellence project. In the governor's budget, there is a cut, a reduction of $602,000 in the Office of Technology Funding, and this is viewed to be the initial phase of what is an anticipated restructuring of our governance operation, including the Office of Technology. As a reminder, the legislature has long since consistently viewed the need for enterprise management of technology across agencies. The Office of Technology was created to forward that theme. It does a number of things quite broadly. It is involved in IT planning and coordination. It does project review and approval for major projects. It is involved in standards development, trying to drive standards across the implementation of technology across the agencies. And also, where possible, the Office of Technology identifies and tries to foster leverage opportunities across agencies. It's fair to say, I think, that the Office of Technology has had mixed success. The office has been fairly successful at establishing interagency dialogue and discussion among agencies on major issues. It also has developed a fairly solid beginning of a planning and standards baseline, which is used by many agencies. But there have been challenges. At the end of the day, the Office of Technology has had really limited operational impact in terms of affecting a lot of real change opportunities. It has been dealing with a mixture of agency buy-in. There are some agencies who are enthusiastic with respect to working with the Office of Technologies and those that are less than enthusiastic. We also believe that the Office of Technology is really suffering under really a lack of an unequivocal statutory mandate. That is, it's not always clear as to what they should do, how they should behave, and it's also not clear at times as to what the bounds of that authority is. That is sort of a reflection of that. The staffing levels are not at the level to fulfill its mission, as well as at the level of expertise required to fulfill its mission. This, of course, was not all unknown to us when we initiated the Drive to Excellence assessment. I'm just going to speak briefly from an IT perspective what we hope to accomplish and what, in fact, we did accomplish, and you'll see as we begin to roll out, are able to roll out the results of the Drive to Excellence. We first of all want to assess the current situation. We want to assess the current situation for the way we manage technology against both public, other public forward-looking organizations as well as the private sector. We want to find out if there were leverage opportunities to view the management of technology differently across the agency system. We felt and desired for the project to produce some governance directions and recommendations, which certainly will affect the Office of Technology. We anticipated that. By and large, we expected these recommendations to drive us to a clear, more defined enterprise view of how to manage technology across the agencies, and I believe we will see that. There is an anticipated new structure, which we are anxious to review with you once the Drive to Excellence roadmap is released, and it's within the context of these recommendations that these savings and this budget cut of $602,000 will be realized. That's the end of my prepared comments. Open for any questions.
Questions from members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Solberg.
Why would we not have the new structure shared with us now?
Sir, when are they planning on doing the Drive to Excellence or the new structure? Is that coming up real soon?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, real soon, we believe. It is currently being reviewed, and I believe is going to be released very soon.
Can we give a definition of very soon?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative, we believe within a week or so.
All right. Well, that's good. Okay, Representative Khan.
Mr. Chairman, as I recall, there used to be, I don't know if it's your position, but the governor used to have a science advisor that was came from the Office of Technology. Does that still exist? Does this governor have a science advisor?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not really familiar with that position. I do know that prior to my coming about 17 months ago, the CIO position was basically synonymous with the Commissioner of Administration. I joined as under my job definition as primarily the Information Technology Advisor.
Well,
Representative Khan.
Mr. Chairman, then, in your capacity as the Information Technology Advisor, what do you think about the comparative value between LIMIC and LPAC and the faith-based initiatives?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not equipped to make that evaluation. I'm not sure it is in the backyard of Information Technology Advice.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, I would think that the existence of LIMIC has got to be, if that's not in the backyard of Information Technology Advice, I don't know what is. So, you know, do you have any thoughts about how, is there any need for some kind of broad-based working intellectual effort that works on information philosophy as opposed to just leaving it to the private sector?
Mr. Chair, Representative, my comments were meant as my ability to make a comparative judgment. Certainly the LIMIC issue, I'm somewhat familiar with the LIMIC issue as it exists in other states. I know our position in terms of managing that new, relatively new technology is an important one. It's an important aspect of base technology in many states, and I think ours probably going forward. That's my personal opinion.
Well,
Representative
Khan, I guess as the CIO of the state, did you deliver that opinion to the Department of Administration, the Department of Finance, and to the Governor's Office in terms of coming out with this budget recommendation?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, I have not.
Well, what do you get to do as Chief Information Officer then? If you don't comment on what I think is a very important information decision being made in the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that the issue of where that technology lies, which is quite outside my purview at this point in time, it has been really adequately represented in terms of the representation here, and I would support that representation of the importance of it.
Okay, Representative Khan, we finally have reached that exciting slide that we've all been waiting for. And this is one of the change items from the supplemental budget. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I'm Dana Badgerow, Commissioner of Administration, and it is my pleasure this morning to present to you an item from the Governor's supplemental budget, which is the establishment of an Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. The Governor has chosen to place that office in the Department of Administration. It is, in fact, not plowing new ground. As we all know, there is a federal Office of Faith-Based Initiatives initiated by President Bush. But there are 20 other states, both Republican and Democrat-led alike, who have initiated faith-based offices. I would also mention that the genesis for the idea of a faith-based initiative came in 1996 with President Clinton's signature on the Charitable Choice Act, which opened the doors for faith-based organizations to compete on an even basis for federal and state grant money. The purpose of this office is really only to ensure that there is access across all state programs to faith-based organizations. It is an effort to attempt to supplement our scarce resources at the state level with those services that are being provided oftentimes by faith-based organizations in the community, close to the action. And it just goes to the principle that government is not the only answer, and in fact, many times it is not the best answer. This would establish a single position in the Department of Administration, a director, a cross-agency and public-private commission that would help ensure that these barriers are broken down. That's the end of my presentation, Mr. Chair.
Okay, questions for members on this item? Representative Kahn?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, as I'm reading the change item, the first thing I see that what the council will focus on is defining and eliminating barriers to faith-based institutions' receipt of state grants. I translate that as teaching them to lobby to get more state money. Could you just explain how that's going to work?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I truly cannot at this point. My understanding is that today at the federal level, for example, faith-based organizations receive only about 10% of the grant monies that are available to private sector entities. There has been effort at the federal level in a number of states to educate faith-based organizations on the availability of grants. This would be an education and outreach program, enabling those faith-based organizations who might previously have felt they were excluded from these kinds of grants to participate on an even basis.
Representative Kahn, as you know, when I had my bill on nonprofit restrictions, there's no shortage of groups that are getting grants. I don't know if there were any faith-based ones in the audience when I had my bill up, but there's certainly came out of the woodwork on everybody who's getting money.
Well,
go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and Madam Commissioner, you spoke about the genesis of this concept. When do you think we'll get to the exodus of it?
Is that a rhetorical question?
No. Well, yes.
Representative Mullery and then Solberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I looked into this maybe about a year ago because I'd heard of it on the federal level. And what I found out was that there really, at that point, for all the talk, there wasn't any thing really happening that had changed anything in the Bush administration, and you still had to qualify by not having any faith-oriented, whatever you want to call it, in the activities if you were asking for a grant. So there were a number of groups in my district that wanted to know about that. Would that be the same here in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I think what you're referring to there is, of course, the principle of the separation of church and state, so that if state or federal monies are going to an activity, it must be divorced from the sectarian activities of that particular organization. And some of the examples I'm familiar with are a lunch program, for example, where it is prohibited to have a prayer service as part of that lunch, because that would indeed then be crossing the line with respect to the separation of church and state. So, but we today in the state of Minnesota have strong partnerships with over 64 faith-based organizations who are in the community providing social services of a secular nature, and we simply want to expand that.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I'm not quite sure. I think you're saying yes to my question that there will be not be an that there will be no change on that. You just want to get other faith-based groups to apply to do completely non-sectarian things, such as maybe allow their basement to be used for a after-school program in a church or something like that, in the basement of a church. Is that what we're getting? In other words, that's what that's what the federal program, at least as of about a year ago, was, maybe a year and a half ago. I haven't looked into it since. Is that the type of thing we're getting into then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, your question would imply some kind of passive involvement of these organizations. To my knowledge, the programs that exist today in the state of Minnesota are quite active. These are agencies who are, in fact, providing services to dislocated workers or to youth after school. They're not simply allowing the use of their facilities. They are, in fact, at the front line providing needed services to the elderly, to youth, to dislocated workers, to prisoners who have been released. So this is the actual delivery of service, not simply some passive activity.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to get an... Okay, I'll try again. Since I'm not Lutheran, I don't know all the specifics of it, but they have... Or it's not Luther.
The
Baptist. I think it's... is it the Baptist that have a program called Awana, where... they would... they bring in youth and work with the youth, and it's good that they're working with at-risk youth, but they do basically have a very religious, and they've told me that they want, and that's probably why the ones I know are not asking for any government money, but would that be a program that would qualify under this, or is that like, it wouldn't qualify under the federal one? Is that something that also wouldn't qualify here then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, I'm just not sufficiently deep into the details of what this program might look like, but I just want to emphasize that the purpose of this requested appropriation is in fact to define the program, to ensure that it avoids, that it passes constitutional muster, to ensure that it does in fact allow equal access. And I think that's the task that is at hand. We need to understand what those barriers are and break them down where possible and where legal.
Okay, Representative Solberg.
Well, Mr. Chair and others, and you know, we have some very strong faith-based organizations that you said deliver some great services. And I'm familiar with some of them in my area, the Catholic Charities, Lutheran Social Service, others provide great services. And you know what I hear from them? Is not that they can't access the funds, but that the funds are being cut that they can access. Mm-hmm. And so we're putting $300,000 into a program to access funds that aren't going to be there because they're being cut. They would rather have the funds to be able to deliver the services. And that's just, I mean, if you want to establish some kind of an outreach assistance program within the Department of Administration, I bet you there's some deputy commissioner or assistant deputy commissioner or an assistant to the assistant deputy commissioner that can actually do this coordinating within the department.
Representative Solberg, if you are interested in this position, I'd be happy to write a letter of recommendation.
Mr. Chairman, no, thank you.
Representative Kroenke.
Thank you.
Thank Representative Kahn.
The difference was that Representative between you and him is that Representative Solberg was not looking to expand government. He was looking at trying to put it into an existing position.
Representative Kroenke.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, can you give me an idea of what the difference between this organization or this proposed entity might be, and I believe you were commissioner previously, so you're aware of the Minnesota Office of Citizenship and Volunteer Services. Can you give me an idea of what the difference between this entity might be and what that entity was?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kroenke, I was indeed here. It was called the Minnesota Office of Volunteer Services when I was here. Obviously, it will differ in scale and scope. It will be but one person, and it will have as its singular focus the opening of doors to faith-based organizations.
Representative Kroenke. Members, to Representative Kahn's earlier point about when the exodus is that... Minnesota Office of Citizenship and Volunteer Services or whatever in its various entities. I think it took us 20 years to finally to put the lid on that organization that was started by Representative... Which governor started that?
Perpich.
Governor Perpich. That creative and wonderful idea started, and I think it was something that was to keep the lieutenant governor busy, and then, of course, evolved out of the governor's office and got placed in the Department of Administration, where we place everything and we don't know where else to place it. And so here we are. It looks to me, members, like we're just going back to create a different name, but somewhat the same the same objective or the same purpose to increase or to connect. So I just assume disconnect state government from a lot of things. I think we meddle in too many things that are out there. So I just assume disconnect instead of connect more things. So this, I think we need a lot more detail about what the what this is going to do versus what the Minnesota Office of Volunteerism did.
Mr. Chairman, I just had a question of you. $150,000 for one person, how does that fall within your other bill that you had?
Well, I think there, part of this is must be office expenses, or I'm not sure that this is all one F. What is the plan for this, Commissioner? Are they going to have a, are they answering their own phone, or what? How does that work?
Mr. Chair, the plan was, of course, salary and fringe benefits, which, as you know, are significant in the state of Minnesota. There would be shared secretarial assistance, and there would be a fair amount of travel, travel throughout the state of Minnesota, because this is not just a metro area initiative, as well as some travel to the federal level for coordination.
Sounds like they fit under the cap, Representative Mallory. Okay, I think we are at, probably at the end. We're going to start with reverse auction tomorrow. Members, if we could keep the presentation, we're going to talk about surplus services, reverse auction, regular auction, procurement, leasing, rentals, agency relocation, and Capitol Complex parking tomorrow. And then we'll just kind of try to blend the bills in that are on the bottom of your agenda because they all relate to the items that we're talking about. If you could put all these items back in your packet. Representative Krenke?
Just one thing. If we could ask the commissioner, we got this information about commercial leases by agency. It's very helpful. We have the office square footage and we have the annual rent. Could we get you to do the math and tell us what the cost per square foot is? I assume we know what the cost per square foot is in these leases. That might be helpful for us.
Commissioner, could we have that for tomorrow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krenke, I'm not sure why we cannot. It will be an average because in some cases there will be separate rental rates for storage and so forth, but we'll give you an average.
Well, or we'll do the math. Something approximate for the majority of the lease.
We'll do.
If you lease 100,000 square feet at X.
Yeah. Are there any other requests for tomorrow? So if the commissioner needs to have the staff prepare any type of report for tomorrow that's different, Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's also helpful to note when examining these leases is whether or not we're at gross, net, triple net. The type of lease is important to know as well.
And perhaps how many years on the leases as well, Commissioner, would be helpful. So whoever's.
Certainly.
Okay. Any other requests for addendums to these items? That's great. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.